This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the Director of Flight Operations for Quantum Spatial about International Standards for Business Aircraft Operations Certification. It's about safety as a value, not safety as a priority. An interesting distinction. In the news, Boeing 737 MAX order deferrals, best practices for small flight department maintenance, masks and COVID-19 in the air, literally, fighter jets in the Middle East, and some information about the next generation U.S. fighter, and high-tech plane floats. We've also got your favorite airplane poll results. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 626 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me this episode is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and he is our expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Max T, welcome back. You were off last week.
I was out jetting around, but I want to tell you, I just came back from a flight this afternoon, and it's 6 mile visibility and smoke out there. It's like the smoke is just never going to end here in California. Just when we think it's over, it comes back.
It's terrible. We feel for you guys. We especially felt for you guys a month or so ago when the smoke all got over here into Connecticut.
But yeah, yeah. Sorry that we're sharing that with you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a bunch. Also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation expert.
Hi, my name's David Vanderhoof, and Air Force One is a call sign, not an airplane. But besides that, I'm looking forward to a great show tonight. We had a great show last week. We missed Max, though we know that he values tooling around in SR-22s much more than valuing us. And we won't even mention Vision Jets.
Oh, okay. I was just going to mention. It was actually the jet that I was in last week. See, I wouldn't leave you guys for the 22, but for the jet, what can I say?
But we had a chance to talk with Rob Mark again. That's always a fun experience. Well, our guest this episode is Josie Billington. He's Director of Flight Operations for Quantum Spatial. Quantum Spatial became the first full-service geospatial company to achieve International Standards for Business Aircraft Operations Certification. This is a designation that was developed by the International Business Aviation Council. It verifies that a company's flight operations division has adopted the best practices necessary to reach high levels of safety, security, and professionalism in its airborne data acquisition activities. Now, Josie's also a former U.S. Marine and airline pilot. He holds an ATP certificate as well as certified flight instructor certificates. Last year, December 2019, Josie obtained the coveted Certified Aviation Manager certificate from the NBAA, the National Business Aviation Association. So, Josie, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hi, thank you very much, Max. Max and David, so happy to be here.
We're really glad to have you. We're going to have an interesting conversation, but of course, that's coming up. But just to get it started, tell us a little bit about the company, Quantum Spatial. What services does the company provide and for who?
So they provide geospatial services for a number of organizations from government, public, private. And really what that means is, for my side, we do aerial surveillance. We acquire data from the air with sensors, and then that data is processed downstream for the end customer to use for whatever problem is they have or something they want to mitigate or solve. So basically, call ourselves air farmers. We're up, you know, going back and forth in the air, collecting data either with very high resolution photo sensors or topographic LIDAR ones, just sensors that shoot a laser beam down and pick up measurements on the earth. But in general, you know, I'm still just flying the plane. And there's a sensor operator on board monitoring the data and advising of any issues.
That's fantastic. We're going to probably have another guest in the future talk about some of those aspects of quantum spatial and what they do, what Josie just described. This episode, Josie's going to focus on aviation safety and training and how companies can adopt these safety standards within their own organization. But of course, we're going to start first with some of the aviation news from the past week. Is everybody ready?
Ready from the West.
Bum, 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 bum.
Oh, you're supposed to say ready.
Ready.
First story, this comes from Bloomberg. Boeing's 737 MAX gets double dose of bad news. Oh my gosh. Bloomberg opens this piece with, this is priceless. And I, you know, I hate to say anything disparaging about Boeing, but the piece opens with, when it comes to Boeing Company's 737 MAX, things can always get worse. Oh, dear. Max Trescott, how are things getting worse now?
Not possible.
Yeah.
You say that, but then next week we'll have another story.
I know. Well, this is not too surprising, actually. Both American and Southwest have said, you know what, we think we'd like to push out deliveries on some of those jets that we were going to take from you just about the time when, you know, Boeing is about ready to get them back into service again. And so I guess in terms of numbers, American has already deferred 18 MAX jets that were supposed to deliver this year and next year, and they're going to push those out for 2 years. Southwest has agreed to take no more than 48 of the planes through December of next year. And this particular story doesn't go through it, but I have seen elsewhere that apparently Southwest has said that they're going to start looking at the Airbus. Now, that is significant because for the last 50 years that Southwest has been in existence, they have only used Boeing 737s. So we don't really know if – not true?
I'm pretty sure they took over, when they took over the 717 – or wait, never mind. I'm getting confused on airline mergers.
It's not hard to do. They've been so
many. Yeah, I was going to say, never mind. Disregard. Scratch that. Go back to 50 years of never flying anything but a 737.
Yeah, and I think that they've been a Boeing-only company, so let's just leave it at that. And they have let it be known that they're going to talk to Airbus at this point. Now, it's hard to know whether that's just a stalking horse where this will help get them a better deal from Boeing, or if they're serious. It could be either, could be sort of both. I mean, I think the problem is companies may initially enter in these kinds of talks thinking, yeah, we'll just use this as a stalking horse. But then they might get intrigued and decide, oh, you know what? Maybe we will actually choose product B, even though we had originally just used this discussion to decrease the price on product A. So, you know, it's not good news for Boeing. I mean, the only good news out of the story that deliveries are being deferred is that at least Boeing won't have to pay on these aircraft because they are late being delivered. You know, obviously, if the company's pushing them out, they can't also make the case that, they need to be compensated because, the airplanes aren't being delivered on time, which we know has gone on for, quite a bit over the last year and a half.
Josie, did you ever fly the 737?
No, actually, I flew the Dornier 328 jet. If any of you are familiar with that one, it actually was a started off as a high wing turboprop. And what they did was threw a couple jet engines on it. I think they're Pratt & Whitney 306 Bravos, if I recall. So you put jet engines on a turboprop, which still held pretty much the same speed characteristics. You're just the traffic jam up at flight level 300. But it could climb, man. Normally you're looking anywhere 7,000 feet a minute, climb out at about 190 knots initially.
Sounds like fun.
And that's one of the reasons why Special Ops uses it in the Air Force, but we're not supposed to talk about things like that.
Oh, I see. I see.
What? Well, they'll fire you, David? Go ahead. Talk about it. I want to know.
I'm more worried about other things happening to me, like monitored. And oh, wait a minute. There are suddenly black helicopters out the door. I think I'll stop.
I think you should stop.
There are several things that we've been talking about a lot for quite a while now. And, to be honest with all of you, we grow weary of some of these things, but they are kind of, significant news items. But the 737 MAX is one of those ongoing things, leaving aside the whole issue of the, you know, the deaths in the two crashes. But Josie, what are you thinking? In some ways, I feel sorry for Boeing for some of the things that have happened. Or in other ways, I'm mad at Boeing for some of the things that have happened. I don't know, just any sort of general thoughts?
Well, it was the original idea to help streamline everything so they could keep one type certificate between like a max and a 8 and a 9, wasn't that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So was it worth it?
Turns out, yeah, not.
I mean, was that cost effective?
Yeah.
I'm not an engineer. I don't deal with it, but you look at the broader picture.
A lot of times a corporation has to make kind of strategic choices, strategic decisions about you know, how something is going to be approached. And I don't know how often it works and how often it doesn't, but in this case, I think it didn't. And the impact on the company and on the FAA has been significant. Hopefully we keep saying it, but hopefully we're seeing the end of that tunnel.
Well, I think the challenge is that managers and companies often have to make decisions with imperfect information. And obviously, hindsight's 20/20. Boeing probably would have made a lot of different decisions knowing what they know now.
Yeah. Although I still would like to see if, you know, there are structural, cultural issues within the company that need to be addressed. You know, did they lose sight of some fundamental things, or are they just kind of the victim of circumstance, which sounds kind of cold to me anyway, but I'm kind of leaning towards a cultural issue. But those things can be difficult to correct in a large corporation and take a lot of time. You know, we think we've had a lot of 2 years, a lot of time with the 737 MAX being grounded, but changing the culture in an organization as large as that can take many times that length of time. So,
I mean, in all fairness, Max, it's got to be a culture issue because it's not just the 737 MAX.
Right. That's a,
it's
those
the
are clues.
KC-46, it's the 777, it's over multiple facilities. It's not just Seattle, it's Seattle and Carolina. And there is a culture where things have gotten slack, you know, and there's a lot of people who have left if it's not Boeing, I'm not going category, because there's been a lot of screw-ups. Even their whole space program had errors that needed to, you know, they put a spacecraft in orbit and it was faulty. So it's definitely a culture thing. And like you said, there's an old saying about, you know, the ship of state has got a really, really tiny rudder. I'm sure that goes with the same for large companies like Boeing. You've got a really, really big wheel at the top, but it turns a very, very, very tiny rudder, and it doesn't turn very quickly.
All right. Well, let's talk about maintenance. We see from the NBAA, the National Business Aviation Association, that they're making a new resource available for its members. It's called Best Practices for Small Flight Department Maintenance. And it offers some practical guidance on maximizing personal resources, obviously while ensuring airworthiness. And the NBAA notes that small flight departments don't typically have a full-time mechanic, and that the flight crew often has to make correct decisions, legally dispatch the aircraft, as they put it. So the guide has some tips for managing time spent on maintenance tasks, things like having detailed plans in advance for certain events and documenting maintenance practices and keeping good records. So this is something that's only available to NBAA members, so we don't have the advantage of the full document. But it's kind of interesting when you look at maintenance and responsibilities for them. Max, when you're flying the Cirrus and all, I mean, who is managing the maintenance of the aircraft that you fly?
Well, it's kind of interesting. The pilot is is responsible to see that all of those things happen. You know, pilot in command is responsible for just about everything related to the aircraft. In our particular case, most of the rental aircraft that I work with are at the West Valley Flying Club. They've got a really excellent maintenance department that stays on top of all these things. When I send people off to check rides, that's the one time that I go through all the maintenance records myself to just make sure that it is, you know, everything is correct and ready prior to going to the check ride. And the vast majority of time, it is. So, you know, I think to some extent, we trust that they are experts and that they are doing their job properly. And on rare occasion, that could get us in trouble since we're responsible. But generally, it works out pretty well.
Josie, does your company manage its own maintenance, or do you outsource that?
We actually have two maintenance technicians and a director of maintenance. But consider how dynamic we are. Our aircraft fleet of roughly 12 aircraft are just all over the United States. So there is outsourcing, but we've identified preferred maintenance facilities to outsource to and have audited them in line with the, you know, the ISBAL standards that we follow. So we just don't show up at a mom and pop shop and say, you know, fix it. We need an oil change. There's actually a process and procedure that goes through to ensure that the aircraft is, that its maintenance is complied with correctly.
And what kind of aircraft are you utilizing?
So right now we have one Cessna Conquest, 2 7 Cessna Caravans, and we have 4 Piper Navajos remaining. We're looking just for a 2-type fleet here eventually. So we're adjusting for our aging fleet, and we're slowly selling off higher time planes and reintroducing newer ones.
All right, good. All right, moving on to some, well, COVID-related news. And this, again, falls into the category of, oh, boy, we talk about this so much. And it's kind of getting wearisome in some respects. But we see from the Washington Post that Cathay Pacific is cutting 8,500 jobs and closing down a regional airline. Are they, Max?
Yeah, it's really unfortunate, but Cathay Pacific has had to let go a lot of people. Not real surprising. I think a lot of what they do is long-haul work, and I think that long-haul traffic is probably the thing that's been most impacted right now around the world, which is not surprising because you've got so many countries which are barring other countries from allowing, you know, passengers to come in, or if they do allow it, they require, you know, quarantines for various periods of time. And some of these countries are extremely aggressive about those, you know, quarantines, you know, to the extent that, you know, you check in a hotel and there is someone who comes by and, you know, randomly checks to make sure that you're, you know, in that hotel room. You don't get to go out and get takeout food. You know, it's got to get delivered. And so I think they're probably hit disproportionately harder than, say, some of our domestic airlines. I'll pick Southwest by comparison, where most of their flights are domestic. Anybody who's, you know, in the long haul business is probably hit, you know, much harder. So yes, this is a major hit to this airline.
You mentioned quarantining and sometimes pretty stringent requirements. There's an interesting article in from NPR. Do masks on plane flights really cut your risk of catching COVID-19? And they tell the story of Hong Kong, which apparently tests arriving passengers, then requires that they quarantine for 14 days and then tests them again. And they've been looking at some data from the different airlines and what the results of the testing, the quarantining, and the retesting have been. And they mentioned that Emirates has particularly strict mask requirements that are enforced. And so they've looked at, well, in one case, over a 3-week period, Emirates had 5 flights with a total of 58 passengers who tested positive for the coronavirus, but none of the other passengers picked up the virus. And there's some other examples like that as well. And what we're starting to see is some data about the safety of catching the virus on board aircraft. And some of these results are tending to point towards, you know, it doesn't seem to be the petri dish that you know, some people were initially thinking, and that with all of the air changes and the the way the air has changed, being pulled up and not blown across and all of these things. So that there's a lot of examples coming up where, you know, the indication is that it's pretty safe. So that's encouraging.
Yeah, and I did my most recent airline flight about 10 days ago, which was the trip where I wasn't able to join you folks last week. And, you know, my conclusion is that in general, it's not the flight itself and the airline that's the problem, especially if you're diligent, you know, with a mask. The problem to me appears to be terminals at hubs, you know, where you may be wall to wall, especially if you're there, you know, on a Friday or something like that, which is odd because some terminals you get to are empty. Others are quite crowded. But I think even more than that, it's the, you know, having to go out and get food, you know, the restaurants. So I think the, you know, when I'm on a trip, I'm most concerned about going into a restaurant, which is why I only do takeout. And I don't have a problem with that, you know. And so I've actually just decided that since it does look like there's a new wave that's spiking here in the U.S., that I'm just going to postpone any further airline trips here for a couple of months because, you know, some of the rates in other states are now significantly higher on a per capita basis than California. And I'm just I'm feeling like I'm going to stick a little closer to home now over the next couple of months.
Yeah, my comment was the flight isn't going to kill you. It's the airport. I really think that that's what the studies are starting to show, that, you know, I mean, if wearing a mask, yes, it's really important on the airplane, but it's even more important when you're in a confined space like an airport. And as the weather gets colder here up in north, you know, it's going to be tighter, and it wouldn't surprise me if they start closing down the restaurants in the airports the way, I mean, that'll be one of the first things to go will be the restaurants. And, you know, it's just for everyone's safety, you know, and the airlines aren't serving food anymore. So questioning about what, you know, what the infrastructure at the airport's going to look like, you know, it's going to be difficult.
Well, and of course, some people are still refusing to wear masks on, well, not only on board, but in the waiting areas, things like that. And of course, we know, we've talked about airlines have policies about requiring masks and so forth, but some people are still refusing. But Max, sounds like some airlines are making lists and checking them twice.
They are. And you don't want to be on the naughty list. You know, I think a lot of people just think, well, if I don't wear my mask, the worst that's going to happen is I get kicked off this flight and, you know, I'll just catch the next flight. Well, the airlines are putting people on a no-fly list. Now, they haven't really said for how long you'll be on that list, but my guess is, you know, maybe through the end of the pandemic, which, you know, could be a year or more. Delta actually just announced that they have a total of 460 people on the naughty list, which means these people are not going to get to fly Delta Airlines again. So they're pretty serious about it. And I think this makes a lot of sense. I'm actually surprised that there were that many people on the list. So that's why this story seems significant to me.
I think Delta ought to share the list with other airlines.
They were talking, I mean, they talked about that when these lists first came out. That the airline, you know, ICAO was going to start distributing the offender list. I don't know if that's legal or not, but 460 people on a no-fly. I wonder what Delta's no-fly list normally would be for a year. You know, I mean, they have a no-fly list, I'm sure, but for, you know, for all the various incidents that occur that we talk about, usually involving large consumptions of alcohol. But that being said, it probably has never been this big in 1 year. I mean, and in all fairness, they're looking out for their own employees. They're providing a service, and why should you risk their people because you've decided something that, you know, and it's not necessarily the law, but it's the business regulation.
Well, you think about it, when you walk into any private business and they may have a sign that says no shirt, no shoes, no service. I mean, it's kind of the same thing. You go to a private business, they get to set the rules, you know, and the airlines have set the rules, whether you agree with them or not. you know, you need to wear a mask. And, you know, if you disagree, well, you shouldn't fly, you know. And if you do, this is the risk that that you run, that you won't get to fly with them again. I got to tell you personally, I would find it incredibly inconvenient to be banned from a airline because, you know, I fly all of them at different points and times. And it would really limit my flexibility to find that, oh, no, now I can only look at, you know, these carriers, which may have less convenient schedules. So, yeah, I that's a list I don't want to be on.
All right. Let's touch on a military item or two really quickly. David, we have something going on with F-22 stealth jets.
This popped up this morning as we record this on Monday, the 26th. With the recent peace treaties with the United Arab Emirates, or UAE, and Israel, one of the underlying discussions was the UAE would like F-35A Lightning IIs. Israel was really, really upset with that because there has always been a rule here in the States that Israel will always have the better equipment than the neighboring Arab states. And the F-35I is already in service in Israel. And they were not happy that the U.S. was considering giving the UAE the F-35. Now, that subsequently changed today. But what really got interesting was Israel came back and said, yeah, we've got no problem with you giving them the F-35. Why don't you give us F-22s? There's a real problem with this.
Yeah,
comment.
I can think of one.
What one's that, Max?
We don't make them anymore.
We don't. And besides that, the tooling was mothballed. It wasn't scrapped. But the amount of money it would take to build the F-22 or rebuild the F-22 is exorbitant. You know, it's not going to happen. But over the last couple of weeks, the Air Force announced that it has flown its next generation fighter, which is the NGAD, or the next generation air dominance fighter. And they've sort of overtly admitted that this sixth generation, which means it's beyond F-22 and F-35, has already flown, you know, and it was kind of interesting that Israel was talking about F-22s and the Air Force is saying we've sort of clandestinely flown the F-whatever, next generation fighter. I think Israel's bucking on the list to be the first exporter of the next generation aircraft beyond the F-35 and beyond the F-22. Keep in mind that this has sort of been a tradition that the top of the line aircraft, the F-15, went to Japan and Israel first. The F-22, because of the ban on the technology, was supposed to go to Israel and Japan first. Japan has worked hard to build another, a fifth generation fighter similar to the F-22. Israel was willing to take the F-35, but with the F-35 spreading out all over the region, it's very clear that Israel feels like they need to have the one step up again. And so it's interesting how these sort of stories have been intertwining, but they're not going to get F-22s because we don't have that many of them. And I can't imagine us forking over used F-22s, though there was a discussion. You know, I said there's only been one owner on a used F-22 and it was flown by a little old lady from Pasadena, if you've watched the demo. But it's going to be interesting to see how this flows. And arms sales have been a carrot for a lot of the Arab countries to sign peace deals with Israel. The problem is they want the stuff Israel has. And so now we've got sort of a diplomatic issue and policy issues that probably won't be discussed until early 2021.
What does the timeline look like for the secret new jet? Is I mean, well, did you say people think that it's been flying, but
The Air Force has admitted they've flown it already.
But does that mean it's operational?
Well, not operational. I mean, it's all aircraft have long lead times, you know, and for example, the F-117 was flying for almost 10 years before it was operationally debuted, you know. It is kind of interesting that the Air Force is leaking out this. And the other article we talked about was the fact that Lockheed Martin is advertising that they're going to build a new factory near Plant 42 for a new program. Now, Plant 42 in California is otherwise known as the Skunk Works. So Lockheed definitely, there's going to be something being built there. And so Lockheed Martin is putting out that news. So it's sort of interesting, this trickle of information is suddenly getting deeper and becoming a bigger river as we go along, that, you know, sooner or later. I mean, last week we had F-117s that aren't supposed to be flying land at Marine Corps Air Station Miramar because they're being used as aggressors, you know, and having three of them out in the open was kind of a very unique story. But it seems to be kind of like, for me, it reminds me of the late 80s where I was tearing through aviation leak and space technology every week to find out what Bill Sweetman had discovered about whatever the latest stealth aircraft was, whether the B-2 or the F-117 or HAVBLUE or whatever. There was these trickles of information and it got exciting that it's coming. And I have a feeling that we're sort of back into that cycle where dribs and drabs and good reporting and all of that's going to come out, so that, you know, there's going to be interesting things happening as far as military jet aircraft going in the next couple of years. It may be 2 or 3 years before we see it, but the fun is watching this stuff happen. Yeah. and it coming out from black to white. So to say,
Josie, in the Marines, were you a pilot?
No, I actually worked in the Marines. I was a grunt.
Oh, okay.
0311 infantry. I signed up in 2001 before September 11th, and that just amplified my desire to go over and fight. I mean, that's the foundation, the heartbeat of the Marine Corps is infantry. Sure. If I wanted to fly, I would have joined the Air Force. Because if you fly for the Marine Corps, you're probably going to be stuck in a helicopter.
Well, but in all fairness, you have to be a Marine first before you become an aviator. You know, all Marines go through ground training, and so they appreciate what their buddies down below are doing more so than the Air Force or the Navy. So I always have a lot more respect for Marine pilots because they are grunts first, pilot second. You know, boorah.
Yeah, it's true. They have to pass a rifle qual, you know, just like a private does at boot camp. So every Marine can shoot.
So you are flying before you joined the Marines, is that right?
So I actually joined the Marine Reserves so I could go to college, get all my certificates. Didn't work out like I thought it did. I kept getting deployed to Iraq. I was there from 04, 05, and then 07, 08. So took a chunk during some of my flight training, but I got it all worked out.
Good. All right.
Max, that's kind of interesting. It's we've talked about, and Max, both Maxes have, ways to pay for your flight training. There's another one where you didn't go into the service to fly per se, but you went into the service to fly per se.
Great stuff. One final news item that came in from Micah, and it's a main story, but it's what caught my attention is the air cam that this is about. A main company goes high tech to make sleek plane floats, and the company is Claymar Floats. They use molded composites to create custom floats, and the president of the company, Paul Richards, says if you look at this, there's not a rivet. It's very clean aerodynamically and hydrodynamically, very clean design. So their primary business is experimental aircraft, hence the air cam. That is an air cam, right, Max?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely.
I love those things. I think we saw those at Sun and Fun last time we had Sun and Fun, which would have been in 2019. I don't know. There's something attractive about that. I don't know, Josie. Do you also think it would just be a real kick in the pants to be flying around in something like an air cam with that, you know, open to the airflow? I mean, a biplane has some of that, but I think something like an air cam or a breezy is just, you know, you're just out there in the wind.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the passion of flight back to the glory days. Minimal instrumentation, stick and rudder skills. You know, since you brought up a new aircraft, I always wanted to fly the Icon 5.
Ah, yes. Yeah, that's looks like a lot of fun. Anything on floats kind of excites me, too. I think Mr. Trescott maybe shares some of that interest in floats.
Yeah, but he owns a boat.
Yes, I have a lake amphibian that I have not given enough care and attention to lately. But I was going to say, I have flown an air cam on floats. There is a gentleman in Florida, I want to say it's Richard Johnson, who's somewhere down in the Orlando area. And I went and did I think probably a couple hours of duel with him. And it's just a spectacular airplane. I mean, the air cam is kind of unusual in that it's a twin engine aircraft. And I think we first all learned about it when they were used by, I think, National Geographic in Africa, because they wanted to be able to fly low over the canopy. Just experimental aircraft. The company is in Florida, and it's just it's also a tail dragger. You know, if you don't have floats, it's kind of unusual to have a twin engine tail dragger. And when you are flying it, you are just out there in the open. If you're in the front seat, there's a little glass plexiglass canopy that comes up, you know, a little ways, but. You feel the air, and the person sitting behind you, it really feels even more air. There's a lot of turbulence created, I think, by the first person, which then, you know, hits the second person. Fortunately, all my time is in the front seat, so I didn't have to experience it. One of the things I thought was intriguing about these floats is that they apparently have built-in radar altimeters.
Yeah, sensors in the floats.
Which is surprising. That's a fairly expensive, you know, microwave type technology. But it makes a lot of sense. Why not know how high your floats are above the water as you're attempting to land? You know, one of the most dangerous types of water landings is the glassy water landing, because in calm situations where the water is just flat and mirror-like, you literally can't tell if you're 5 feet above the water or 200 feet above the water. And it's hard to even believe that's possible until you experience it, and it's really spooky. And some of the accidents that occur are from glassy water landings gone badly. And essentially, the technique is to, you know, set up for a very slow descent rate, and you know you've landed when you feel that plop as you hit the water, because you don't know when it's coming. But a radar altimeter makes a lot of sense for a seaplane, because it kind of tells you, hey, here comes the landing.
It's a very great idea. Very cool. All right, again, our guest this episode is Josie Billington, Director of Flight Operations with Quantum Spatial. Josie, can we talk a little bit about these international standards for business aircraft operations, this certification? What are these standards for? What's their purpose?
Being under Part 91, which majority of the people in the U.S., you know, are flying, ones that own their planes, owner-operators, there really is a minimal standard for that. Our company really is under Part 91 is the same as, you know, Uncle Ben who flies his cub from his farm. The reason that the FAA, I mean, keeps it so broad is because there's no way they have the resources to govern anything more like a 135 and God forbid a 121. So this is the opportunity for companies to enhance their safety culture, as we view safety as a core value, and it's there for our personnel, our greatest assets. It's a way to keep them safe. If we do believe in human capital as a competitive advantage, I think it's just, for us, it was automatic to introduce these new standards and allow us to set the industry or the standard in our industry, and that is aerial mapping.
Well, how were the standards developed? I mean, who participated in that process?
So I back the International Business Aviation Council. They were formed, I believe, in 1981. And they're just a governing body. They're a nonprofit organization, but they took the ICAO standards and recommended practices as their kind of their main foundation for setting the ISBAO up, and then developed it off that with the help of standard members, board standard members from other operators. So it's for operators by operators, these standards.
And how does the certification process work? Is there a group that goes out and audits companies or, you know, to the standards? Is that how this works?
I think, well, just to start at the beginning with it, your company would first want it, and then you have to purchase the standard suite kick. And then you do a gap analysis of your company, attend a workshop. And then that's when you get a hold of some type of IVAC representative, either through an association you're with, like MBAA, and then they'll start to set up the auditor to come in. But it's not like you just start bare. And that's why it's so important to go through the ISBAO manual first, which you have to purchase through IBAC, identify where your gaps are, and then start to develop it. And then you bring in the auditors, and they go through a 2-day event, very meticulously going through every single aspect of your organization. Something on the order of like 14 major operational areas, like flight operation, mechanical operations. And then they go through a list of well over 100 elements to verify if you are in compliance with ISBAO. Whatever findings they do find, they reveal them to you, and they allow you so many days to satisfy those findings before they give you certification. Worst case scenario is if a young company just does this out of the blue, the ISBAO auditors show up and they pretty much give them a gap analysis saying, hey, fix this. Call us back because you have way too many findings for us to get you certified anytime soon.
So what drove Quantum Spatial to want to go through this process? I mean, it sounds like this is, potentially not simple. It sounds like it could be time consuming. It sounds like it could be expensive. So what did Quantum Spatial, what was their thinking when they decided to go down this path?
Yeah, it's a good question. A lot of times people bring that up and say, well, you must, you know, with your clientele, you must get better contracts. And it was always geared around production, which is completely the opposite of why we did this. The primary reason we did this was to support the fact that safety is a core value in our corporation and that our employees are our greatest assets. And the question is, why wouldn't we do this? Why wouldn't we give them the best, invest in our human capital? And then byproducts are better contracts, a higher level of safety. And, you know, just improvement in our safety culture. Safety cultures don't just exist. You have to nurture them and create them and keep them going yourself.
And maintain them.
Absolutely.
How did senior management participate in this process or lead this process or guide it? What was the role that senior management played?
Well, that's where you get buy-in initially. Safety starts at the top, and through vertical communication is sent down the lines and then spread out. So without senior management buy-in, this doesn't exist. Without them signing their name on the safety policy, stating that safety is a core value, that it's a just culture, one that we promote at all costs, it doesn't exist. It starts from the top. A lot of the times people talk about safety being a priority, safety first, and I couldn't agree with them, disagree with them even more, because safety is not first. And some viewers can be like, what? Safety is not a priority. Priorities shift. Making money is first for the company. Production is first. Safety is a core value. So it's ingrained. It's automatic. It's a lifestyle. We were talking about culture before with Boeing. Mm-hmm. And culture is people. It's beliefs. It's ideas. It's how you just act. I mean, being in Wisconsin, I'm a Green Bay Packer fan. That's our culture. That's automatic. And there's beer and cheese, right? Okay, that's a culture. Safety is a culture in a corporation.
Yeah, this resonates with me pretty well because just this issue of making something, in this case, we're talking about safety, a core value. Companies can have other core values as well. And I really like the way that you describe a core value as being something different than a priority. Many times people conflate the two of them, and they're really different things. What about funding? Were there difficulties funding this? I'm thinking back to ISO 9001 certification that many companies went through, starting some time ago. And a lot of money got spent, not only internally with the company, but also with external consultants and, you know, folks to guide the company through the process. Does this kind of certification share some of those qualities?
I'm not too familiar with that, but it's expensive, but, you know, it's very cost effective. Increasing safety versus the alternative of what, losing a life, losing aircraft. So you look at the numbers. I mean, let's say maybe it was $20,000, just to throw a number out there for his BALIS certification. How much does a human life cost? You know, then you break it down. How much does a expensive asset cost? So what if introducing this and abiding by these and complying with these policies, what if that saves lives? Isn't it worth it? Absolutely. It's, you can't put a price tag on it. Yes, there are noticeable costs involved.
And how about the timeline or the length of time spent in this process? And is it really a process that starts and then ends, or is it an ongoing process?
No, it's ongoing. We're stage one certified, so our safety management system is in place, and we pass the audit. And now in 2 years, we go to stage two. You cannot sit at stage one. You go to stage two, and that's when they verify you're doing what you said you were going to do. They're verifying that you are controlling and mitigating risks. And then past that, you know, years and years down the road, you can go up to stage three, which is, you know, you fostered a positive safety culture. You're right in line with everything that is BALIS about. So it's ongoing. The world's changing. With change, I mean, you have to adapt to it. You have to evolve. And safety changes too.
I like the fact that Josie, when you bring someone new into the organization, everybody is on the same page with this, like you said, culture. You know, it's not, well, this department does this, this department does that. There's a framework, there's a guideline that you can reference that everybody understands that X means X and not, you know, X means Y if you're in flight services, or if you're in maintenance, it means, you know, it's a really good, comfortable thing that you can say, this is our standard for safety.
Yes, absolutely. And we have we've modeled our whole flight training program off of 121 operations. So we bring our pilots in for in-doc. They go to flight safety for initial, and then they go on to IOE. And, you know, every 6 months they have a check. We'll just leave it at that. But the first thing I bring in, I talk about during in-doc, is our safety culture. Let them know it is a just culture and that there is open reporting. We have software on the pilots' iPads and the sensor operators' iPads, or they can submit anonymous hazard reports all the time. When we're talking safety, it's really four P's. It's being proactive, you're promoting, you're participating, and the last one's pennies, because safety isn't free. You know, you can sit and say, oh, I'm going to be safe. Let's be safe today. I got a coffee mug that says I'm safe. Well, no, this stuff costs money. But the biggest things are promotion and participation.
Josie, can you give us maybe a few examples or an example of the kinds of safety elements that, well, either the Quantum Spatial improved or worked on or beefed up, or just even in general, if you don't want to get into specifics, so that people can kind of get an idea when we're talking about safety here from the director of flight operations, what are we talking about?
So we came in with a solid foundation with our training program. A lot of the small things we had to correct was just verbiage in our general operations manual. Instead of oxygen, put on oxygen at, you know, 12,500 feet for unpressurized. It's 10,000 feet now. We land with an hour of gas. Our duty times was a big one. We have a flight, a fatigue risk management system now. Pilots are limited to certain duty times, certain hours, which we had before, but they weren't, you know, as strict as what ISBAL provides, which is more 135 style operations. Just a couple of them. And then going over on our maintenance side, having full audits done for our preferred maintenance providers, going in myself and the director of maintenance and auditing them to see what kind of operation they hold. And the same thing for some of our subcontractors we use on the flight side. You know, do these contractors have an SMS, our safety management system? Do they have a training program? Who are we contracting out to do some of our work? Because that's our name on the line. You know, do a comparison to the majors how they contract out to the regionals. We recall when the Colgan flight went down 3401 in Buffalo. I mean, that was a smear for United, because most passengers don't know that, you know, it's a regional airplane. They think, oh, that's United.
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about, you know, subcontractors, suppliers, you know, those kinds of things, because if a company has a safety culture or any type of values, and the supplier base, the value chain, if you will, doesn't share those as well to the ultimate consumer, it's much less effective. You really do need to kind of run up and down through the value chain. And sometimes it can be difficult. You may have in one particular company a commitment to safety as a value, let's say, because that's what we're talking about. But, you know, a supplier, a particular supplier, may not feel, for whatever reason, so compelled to share the same values, or at least share them to the same degree. And sometimes it can be difficult to help them understand why they should share those values to that same degree. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about other things that the director of flight operations does. What else fills your day?
Well, taking care of 22 pilots fills my day. I'm a father of three girls and a boy, so wow. I have some comparisons. No, they're a great bunch of guys, but there's training. There's required training events. Like I said, every 6 months we have something going on, whether it's recurrent training at a professional institution. We have LOFT, or line-oriented flight training flights, where one of our chief pilots goes up with the, you know, who's ever due for training in the actual plane, and they conduct an event to verify that the pilot is abiding by our operations, our standards, our procedures. And also, because of the work we do, so much of it is VFR. We don't get to shoot approaches all the time. So this is another opportunity to be satisfied with our IFR currency. And, you know, I've heard before people say, well, since you don't fly IFR much, why do you train for that? Well, that's exactly why we train for it, because we don't do it that much. We still need to go from A to B, and then we do our work. Sometimes you got to go through some nasty weather to get there.
Yeah, Max Trescott is shaking his head in agreement.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, you folks are working across the entire country, and at any given point in time, there may be weather between you and that part of the country that you're trying to get to. So, yeah, absolutely, it's critical.
Mm-hmm. But, okay, Josie, let's talk real important stuff.
Uh-oh.
What's your favorite aircraft to fly that you get to on a regular basis?
David's jumping ahead to the segment that's coming.
Actually, you know, I've flown jets, turboprops, small planes, whatever. The Cessna Conquest 2, I think pound for pound, is the most powerful turboprop ever made. And Cessna stopped making it because it was competing with their entry-level jets. This is an incredible aircraft. I mean, you go up 35,000 feet. You're trimming out about 315. You know, cabin pressure of 8,000 to 9,000 feet in a turboprop that high. Garrett engines just roaring. It is so much fun. And then you can get it in the small fields. We have a division in Anchorage, and we land at Merrill Field, if you're familiar with that. It's a little 4,000-foot strip in downtown, you know, Anchorage area. You can bring the Conquest right in there. It's an incredible machine.
You need to see Josie's smile right now as he was talking about flying into that 4,000-foot airstrip.
Yeah, there's some passion there. We can see that. We can see that. Josie, where do your pilots come from?
We tend to be picking up a lot from smaller aerial surveillance firms that are flying Cessna 172s doing oblique imagery. It's a unique position because you have to talk and fly the airplane and have situational awareness. As a flight instructor, it's hard enough having some of the students fly the plane, and then you got to tell them, you got to talk on the radio too. So we're picking up younger pilots, you know, 1,000 hours plus, but they've done this type of work before in highly concentrated airspaces like Bravo. They've worked in military operating areas. They've worked the Northeast Corridor doing mapping, you know, working their flight lines inside of airline traffic coming in. So we have been seeking people like that. And of course, outside of that, I mean, do you even want to do this? Do you want to fly survey? Because let's be honest, it's not sexy. I didn't grow up being, yeah, I want to fly surveys. No, I wanted to be an airline pilot. I flew for Midwest Connect. I wanted to fly for Midwest Airlines my whole life. But this has become my passion and something I really enjoy doing.
I'm curious if people often think of, you know, airplanes that are doing the kind of work you're doing as, you know, having cameras that are, you know, exposing, you know, film or, you know, digital versions of cameras. But you've got some fairly sophisticated sensors on board. Talk about some of the sensors that you carry and, you know, how they're different from, you know, just pointing a camera down at the ground.
Yeah, so we don't have like an Nikon, you know, we got a handheld in the plane. There's actually a hole in the aircraft, which just doesn't seem normal the way it is. And then you're talking these very expensive sensors, $1 to $2 million, and the data they collect, the imagery or the topographic data they collect is just incredible. The final product is really mind blowing what companies can use this for. And it's just advancing every year at an incredible rate. Last year, I was in Alaska flying over the Tungus Forest at 25,000 feet with a high imagery resolution camera for the national forestry industry, picking up high resolution pics from above the forest. For what? You know, I don't really know, but
it's probably a growing business. I think the demand for this kind of data, and whether it comes from manned aircraft or, you know, other sources, certainly a lot of
don't bring up that other show.
Yeah, the unmanned aircraft.
Those.
Yeah. But the aerial data collection, though, just seems to be sort of a, I don't know if vibrant is the right word, but it does seem to be kind of a growing kind of a thing as people become more and more aware of just what kinds of information and how valuable it can be when you. You know, when you have it, you know, digitized to really, you know, amazing resolution and all. It's it's kind of neat stuff.
Well, it's amazing. You do change the way someone views their world. That's, you know, when we give the data to our clients, you change something for them. It's incredible.
Yeah, very cool.
Well, it's fascinating too that the sensors could be you know, comparable in value to the airplane that's carrying.
Yeah,
them. I don't think
people,
isn't that amazing?
Usually think about that. Yeah, exactly. On the website for Quantum Spatial, it talks about LIDAR. Is that something that's carried in your aircraft, and how? What kind of data, you know, would you guess you can get from that versus standard cameras?
So LIDAR is the laser pointer that shoots out of the plane. You know, basic terms. And it's picking up incredible accuracies on the ground. Some of the LIDAR projects we've done, after the data is collected, they can remove trees, they can remove leaves. I mean, they can remove so many, you know, obstacles in its way and then get to the root of what they're looking for. A lot of that technology is advanced for me to even talk about. In your next episode, you can really get someone going on it. But some of the cool operations we've done in the past that are understandable for everyone is finding ancient pyramids in Georgia using LIDAR. As they shoot down, they can remove the canopy, and then they found these mounds. And it was actually previewed on the History Channel.
Yes.
I mean, it's stuff like that is so cool. And you see more and more of these, whether it's History, Discovery Channel, are utilizing this technology in some fashion, whether it's on a UAV or mobile LIDAR in a car or in an aircraft. It really is. It's a wave of the future, and the problem solving that's coming from it is tremendous.
What's it like to set up a mission? Someone comes in and says, I want you to map this. What steps, I mean, how much back and forth do you go with the client? How much leeway do you have on planning it? What kind of authority you have? Talk a little bit about the profile of a mission.
So I step in mainly on the flight side to help if it's in restricted areas or high density areas of traffic. But when a client comes to the company, I mean, they're going to tell them, I want this. Can you do that? And then parameters are set. Flight plans are made. That data is then uploaded into the aircraft. And I have my own little pilot display that shows me where to fly. And then the sensor operator has a larger computer system monitoring the system and give me any feedback that's needed. So we may have a project that's 100 flight lines or in the thousands of flight lines. And you're collecting that data at various altitudes, you know, various locations. And then once the data is collected, it's shipped off to one of our processing centers. And then the folks there produce what the client wants and solve their problem.
Right. Very good. Those processing centers must have a lot of computational horsepower behind them.
It's phenomenal. I remember landing after one flight, a high resolution flight with one of our digital imagery cameras. And we had about 2 terabytes of data after one mission. And at the end of the day, you had 4. And that's Yeah, it's just overwhelming.
Yeah, it's phenomenal.
Well, you don't just upload that at night to the...
No. You don't use the hotel internet to upload that. No. You send that stuff FedEx.
Very good. All right, Josie, where can people learn more about Quantum Spatial?
By going to our website, quantumspatial.com, it has a wealth of information about what we do. And as I mentioned before, people were looking for to be a part of this company. You know, we want them to believe in our why, have a passion for what we do, like what we do. And there's a wealth of information on that website. They can look at videos. They can read to their heart's content.
All right. Well, great. Josie, I want to thank you for coming on the Airplane Geeks podcast, sharing with us some of your experiences and lessons for helping to build a safety culture within an organization. Again, thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
What's up with the geeks? I think the big thing that's up with the geeks is, Max, you've been flying the Vision jet again.
I've been having more fun than anybody should have. It's just been a kick. Yeah, so over the last 6 days, put about 25, 26 hours on the Vision jet with a new owner who has just finished his type rating. And after people get their type rating in the simulator in Knoxville, they need 25 hours of supervised operating experience. And so I did the supervising, which is just way too much fun. We departed Knoxville and went to Olathe, Kansas, and then to Centennial Airport, just south of Denver. From there, the next morning, we headed off to Santa Fe. And then from Santa Fe, we were going to go into Eagle County, which is way up in the Rockies, and is a rather challenging airport to get in and out of. But it also had some icing right overhead, including some...
vanilla or chocolate.
the kind that sticks to the wings. And so we diverted and went to Grand Junction instead. I'd never been to Grand Junction before, but yeah, huge, huge airport. You know, still at a high elevation, but down in a valley, and great, you know, easy to access. And then from there, we went to Jackson Hole, and that turned out to be kind of interesting because when we looked at the departure procedure, it required a climb rate that after a lot of calculation, we said, yeah, we can certainly make that, but it was raining and there was icing and it was like, okay, and can we make it under those conditions? And the answer was probably yes. And whenever I hear the word probably in my vocabulary, when I'm doing something related to aviation, my next thought is, and what other options do we have?
Sure.
Because I'm always looking for, you know, flight plans and solutions that are going to be 100% achievable. I don't want any doubt. So we decided to spend the night and the next morning, hey, it was much clearer. Now, we still had the challenge of you know, meeting the climb rate, which would have taken us into the clouds. And I just decided, you know what, be safer just to depart to VFR, climb up through the you know, the open portion of the sky as opposed to the you know, the cloudy part that the departure procedure would take us through. So that was great. You know, the Vision jet is wonderful in many, many regards, but it has a fundamental limitation, which is it only has one engine. And so, as you can imagine, it doesn't have the same kind of performance you have with most jets, which have two engines. So the trade-off is, yeah, it's got fabulous design, fabulous avionics, lots of space. It's roomy. It's comfortable. But it just doesn't climb, you know, like an airliner or other kinds of jets. And so that requires more calculation, more thought about how you're going to get out of some of these challenging places. So that was you know, really great experience, you know, for the client, for me as well, too. We went from there to Tacoma Narrows Airport, which I'd never been to before, just in the Seattle area to the southwest of Seattle. And then our next leg was pretty cool. We went directly from Seattle to San Diego in 3 hours, which, you know, certainly you don't think about covering the entire coast usually in a Cirrus that quickly. From San Diego, we were headed back for the pilot's home base of Watsonville. And wouldn't you know, that's where we encountered the worst weather of the entire trip. And at 400 feet above the ground, we could not see the ground. And so we had to fly the missed approach and divert to Salinas, which then meant you know, using an Uber to get back to the airport. So really fun adventure. And I mean, great way to spend 25 hours crisscrossing the West Coast of the United States.
And you get paid for all this, right?
Oh, yeah, because there's no way I would do this for free.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, I bet.
Well, wait, no, I might, but yeah. No,
it's, we can't tell his clients that.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, yeah, I had to do this trip, you know, what can I say?
You mentioned icing. You know, I don't understand icing. They really don't. I mean, when we talk about icing on an aircraft, I mean, we can talk about a very small amount of ice causing huge, huge problems aerodynamically, right? So how can that thin film of ice cause all those problems? And at the same time, you can hang all this oddly shaped ordnance and things and all kinds of stuff under the wing and all over it. I don't understand.
Because most of the stuff isn't on the top of the wing, it's on the bottom of the wing. The ice on the top is the problem.
Well, but don't you need two sides of a wing in order to fly an airplane? Or no, you just need a top side? I mean,
Josie, you're in icing country. You go ahead and take it.
Yeah, I mean, initially it's building on the leading edge of your flying surfaces, right? Because our wings support the weight of the plane. So you disrupt that, you change the wing. You don't know what it's going to do anymore. It's no longer a nice laminar flow or smooth surface. But now you have disturbed air flowing over your wings, the wings that keep you aloft. I think maybe, Max, you've had experience with Rhyme ice before.
Yeah, so I have to confess, I don't have tons of icing experience. But yes, I have had some with the Rhyme. You know, and the Rhyme is not going to be as smooth as the clear ice. But you've hit the key aspect, which is the shape of the wing changes. And that just destroys lift. And so it doesn't take a whole lot of ice, but you know, certainly ice of funky shape is going to makes things worse sooner. I think a lot of people think, oh, it's the weight that's the problem. No, usually it's not the weight. Usually it's the fact that instead of having a perfectly shaped wing designed by an aeronautical engineer, now you have something that's junk, right? I mean, so, the thing I have found is that, ice cubes have very poor aerodynamic properties.
I guess I can believe that.
Yeah. Growing up as a modeler, de-icing boots were always a very fascinating thing to me, like the leading edge of a B-17, which had an inflatable de-icing boot. Mm-hmm. You pump the air in, the air cracks the ice on the leading edge, and it suddenly magically blows off the back of the wing, but it doesn't. It was sort of like, okay, why is that a different color? Oh, that's a pneumatic de-ice. It does what? It, ice has kind of been a problem for a long time. Not that we fly open cockpits anymore, but ice has always been an issue with flight, especially when you start getting to altitude.
Yeah, the only client I have ever lost was in an icing accident about a year and a quarter ago. So, yeah, I mean it's serious stuff. It still kills pilots even today.
We have some listener poll results that we'd like to share with you from episode 623. Our question was, "What is your favorite aircraft and why?" And we got a lot of really interesting responses. And almost every one of them is unique. And I'll ask you guys to pick out maybe a couple of favorite responses. But one that I liked was, what's your favorite aircraft and why? Mine, because it's mine. Said others may be bigger, faster, more economical, practical, sexier, but this one is mine. So I like that. We got a Hawker Tempest. The CH-53C Stallion, because of its heavy lift capabilities. Of course, the Boeing 747. Why? Because it's the queen of the skies.
And that shows up at least three times in the list.
Yeah, that one does. That's of all of them, that may be the one that's most common. But there's some other interesting responses in there as well. What did you guys find interesting in this list?
The one that I thought was really kind of, and I highlighted it because I wanted to make sure that we talked about it, was I was not expecting this. We talked about flying boats, One was a turbine-powered Grumman Albatross with a VIP interior. It's like a luxury yacht that can fly around the world using paved runways or approved waterways. Heaven. I was like, ooh, a turbine Albatross. Albatross. The Grumman seaplanes are some of my favorites. But it was just sort of, I was not expecting to see an amphib show up in the list.
There's one in the museum, the Hiller Museum in San Carlos, California, and it has a VIP interior, and it did go around the world. Now, I don't recall whether it had been upgraded with turbine engines, but yeah, it's pretty spectacular to walk inside of one of those things and, you know, see the mahogany, and, you know, it's just pretty darn cool way to travel.
Mm. Another one that I think we had a couple of responses on was the A-10. We had one... from a 14-year-old, he says his favorite airplane is the A-10 Warthog because I would like to fly it. He says, I'm only 14 and hope to get my glider license. Very cool. Keep up the good work, he says. What else?
There was ones along the lines of this statement. Whichever one I'm looking at.
Yeah, that's cool too.
Or whatever one I'm flying in, or themes and variations of there. That's cheating, guys. You were supposed to pick an airplane.
Well, the DC-3 shows up 3 times in the list as well, too.
So
that's a pretty good choice.
Yeah. I didn't know what a Marchetti SF-260 was, so I had to look it up. But the person that responded to the poll said, designed by the legendary Italian designer Stelio Frati. He said the SF-260 is simply... It's quite simply one of the sexiest light planes ever designed. Painted red, it looks like it's doing 200 miles an hour just sitting on the ramp. So I had to look that up, and that is a pretty sleek-looking little plane. I guess that's typically a trainer, David?
A lead-in fighter trainer, yep.
Yeah.
And there are some companies in the past that have used those for, you know, kind of experiences where if you want to play, you know, dogfighter pilot for the day, they'll have a pair of these and they'll train you and then they'll go fly in those. There are a couple of them here in the area here. I see them occasionally.
One of the respondents who mentioned the DC-3, I like this. I had to kind of read it twice because he says, you know, why is it the DC-3 his favorite? Because as a child, there was one at the local McDonald's. I had to think about that. And he says, I never got to have my birthday in it, but I was hooked. So I think that's a pretty cool memory.
I can relate to that because I had my birthday in a Constellation. There was a restaurant here in Pennsylvania right around the corner that was called the Constellation Bar and Grill. And on top of it was a Constellation. And I actually had my 4th birthday in the Constellation. Luckily, they saved the aircraft, and it's at one of my all-time favorite museums. I can view it now at Dover at the Air Mobility Command Museum. They took it off the restaurant and saved it and restored it as an Air Force Connie. But I could relate to the DC and 3 and McDonald's and having birthday in a restaurant airplane converted to a restaurant. Much like all of the A380s that we've talked about recently that have become restaurants that don't go anywhere.
Another one was the DH Mosquito. It says the first multi-role aircraft ever. He says, also, what is cooler than 2 Merlin engines? I think that's...
if you talk to a Lancaster pilot, 4. Okay, number 36, Trescott, you have to read.
Yeah.
Okay, but let me read this other one first. TBM 900 for its versatility. Now, I think that's spot on. I don't know about the 900 being, you know, a whole lot different than some of the others in that series. They've subsequently had the 910 and now the 940. But, you know, these are pretty fast turboprops, which also have very short field landing, you know, characteristics. So that's, you know, that's a great combination. You got a fast airplane that can get into a small airfield. Which is, you know, a lot of airplanes, if they're fast, you know, they need long runways. So, yeah, it is a versatile aircraft.
It's funny because it's got a very strange, a TBM has a very interesting sound. We have 2 that come into KOQN regularly, and I can tell when one of them, it's like, oh, that's one of the TBMs. Now, but Max, continue. with your 36.
Oh, sure. Somebody, this is cute. Somebody said the Cirrus Vision SF50 because Max Truscott told me to say so or else. I don't. Now, that's not true. I don't know who said this, and I would not have told them or else.
All right. Yeah, great list. Thanks for all who sent in. And there are many others in that list as well. I was kind of, well, there are a few planes that had, you know, several votes or several mentions. I was kind of, I don't know, surprised, I guess, that there was such
a diversity.
Yes, just amazing. Yeah. Military planes, commercial planes, you know, GA planes, jets, props.
Josie, you want to chime in?
I was looking at number 19, actually, the ATR-72. I love what he wrote. He goes, flew like an old farm truck, but always would get you there. Great memory, short landings, Caribbean flying. It was the best.
Cool. Pretty neat. Yes. Great list. Maybe we should put this up someplace, but thanks to
all. Put it up in the show. You could always put it up in the show notes.
Yeah, we could do that. All right, so last week's poll is still active. That was when did you start listening to Airplane Geeks? And sort of the preliminary results are interesting, and we'll talk about that probably next week. So we have a poll for this week, and again, these are just intended to be, you know, very simple, fast. You know, you can click on a link, submit an answer really quick, and then get on with your life. Nothing. Nothing very complicated, and they're completely anonymous. We have no way of knowing who, or there's no email address, there's nothing, none of that kind of stuff. So this week's poll is, and again, this is from one of the questions. One of the early polls was, what questions should we ask in polls? And so that's what we've been, you know, kind of working off of. So this week's poll question is, what is the longest flight you have ever been on? And because this is episode 626, you can find the poll at airplanegeeks.com/poll626. So we hope you participate in that.
Hey, here's a related question for you. I saw a story on this just a couple of days ago. What's the longest domestic flight in the U.S.?
Oh, the longest domestic flight?
Yeah, airline flight. Mm-hmm. And apparently this was suspended for a while, but they're just now putting it back in service, which is why it made the news.
I saw it was New York to,
I don't know.
No, it was to Hawaii. It was Hawaii, New York. It was Hawaii Air, and it was New York to Hawaii, right?
You're close. Now, I thought it was going to be something like an Anchorage to Miami flight, but I guess nobody, there's not enough call for that. Not enough passengers. Now it's Honolulu to Boston.
Oh, huh.
Which I thought was really kind of interesting. It was like, that's a long flight for a quote, domestic flight.
Mm-hmm. And if you'd spent a long winter in Boston, you'd be willing to sit that long to go to Hawaii.
I don't remember what the hours were.
Well, I don't know the hours. It's 5,095 miles. I think it was about 10 hours. I'll have to look it up.
You figure five across country and then five to Hawaii when I did it.
An extra one for Boston. So an 11-hour, 35-minute flight, they say.
Amazing. Wow.
What aircraft are they using?
A330s?
Yeah, I'd have to look.
Well, all they've got is A330s, a lot of 717s, but they're not going to make that distance.
No.
So I'm pretty sure it's an A330.
Okay. All right. We have a short story that Micah sent along. This is titled Made My Day. And this is about how an Airplane Geeks listener made Micah's day.
It had been an awful day. It started with a phone call dealing with health insurance choices for 2021. Deductibles, medications, copays. It was 3 hours on the phone. Time I will never get back. Then another phone call. This one only 90 minutes with a retirement benefits manager from my former employer. This time I'm talking about beneficiaries, guaranteed payments, annuity payouts, and withholdings. Really fun stuff. All the while, I was thinking of something Woody Allen once said, that his vision of hell was being locked in a room for eternity with an insurance salesman. I can see that. The day drags on with more fun things like I've described, and now it's 1700. I still have to go grocery shopping. my favorite grocery store, is part of a local New England chain that Consumer Reports always rates as tops in everything. Market Basket opened its first main store in Biddeford, not too far from B-19, the Biddeford Municipal Airport. For the past 7 years or so, I would drive the 20 minutes every couple of weeks to do my grocery shopping there. It's worth the travel time. Once while there, I had a chance to meet the company president, Arthur T. DeMula. What a nice guy. Recently, Market Basket opened up a second location in Maine, this one about 5 minutes away. I hadn't been there before, and being it was so late in the day, I decided to check it out and save some travel time. I generally don't mind going grocery shopping, but after the day I had, I just wasn't in the mood. But I did need to get a few things, so I drove on over to the new Market Basket store in Westbrook. My first stop was a deli counter. There was a sale on Virginia ham, something I just love. If you think about it, it's really American prosciutto and can truly be a gourmet product. I get to the counter, of course wearing my surgical mask to be socially responsible and follow the local laws. And the guy behind the counter says, "Can I help you?" "Sure," I said. "Let me have a half a pound." That's a quarter of a kilo for those of you outside the USA. "A half a pound of Virginia ham." And the guy behind the counter says, "I'd know that voice anywhere." "Oh," I said, "well, you must have worked in the Biddeford store." "No," he says, "I listen to the Airplane Geeks. You're Micah." I was stupefied. He takes my order and we chit-chat for a bit. He's a former firefighter from my end of town, just started at Market Basket after leaving the South Portland Fire Department. We talked a little about the Spurwink Farm pancake breakfast and fly-in, and how he had never been there but was hoping to get there this year, before COVID hit. We talked a bit about the new Smithsonian Channel show, Space Disasters, and how you can take Bill Barry out of the NASA History Office, but you can't take the NASA History Office out of Bill Barry. It was a nice conversation, and if it weren't for the other customers, I'm sure it could have gone on for hours. So I want to thank Thomas. Thanks for saying hello, and for taking what was one miserable day and making it a great one. That day when I met Arthur T. DeMula, I told him I always believed that Market Basket advertising should be done with a slogan that says something like this: Market Basket has the best of three P's, the best products, the best prices, and the best people. Today, Thomas in the deli department just proved my point. For the Airplane Geeks, here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
Well, we'd like to thank Micah for that story.
Yeah, thanks, Micah. It's really kind of interesting how sometimes we run across listeners, and it's also amazing how just, you know, the sound of someone's voice can trigger, you know, I know who that is. So thanks, Micah. All right, on to some listener mail real quick. Tom sent us an article from Discover Magazine, how the Aurora Borealis nearly started World War III. And we also have a video that covers this. This was about a U-2 pilot during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The short version of the story is he couldn't navigate because of the aurora, couldn't see the stars. And when he started hearing Russian radio stations, he knew something was up and he was in the wrong place. So he kind of turned back. He was chased by some MiGs. Some U.S. fighters were scrambled. It's an interesting story. So I'll have a link to that Discover Magazine article. It's from 2013, but it's interesting. And also the video that also captures that.
And keep in mind, it wasn't over Cuba.
No,
even
wasn't.
Though it was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. During the Cuban, I mean, there was a U-2 shot down during the crisis. So, but this happened to be a European flight, and the astronavigation and magnetic navigation went out, and suddenly he was in trouble. So it is an interesting story that, you know, high altitude flight has, besides icing, has a lot of other issues involved.
Also, we heard from our friend Patrick Wiggins. He says, sitting here in my observatory, because he does volunteer astronomy research, so he really does sit in an observatory. He says, mindlessly watching to make sure the equipment continues to not screw up while listening to the newest episode. And he said he had a couple of thoughts, and one thought's actually been shared by a couple others. As you know, We've had some episodes without guests, and we have a pretty good track record of pretty much always having a guest, but there's been more cases where that's not been the case in the last few months, mostly, actually entirely, that's because I'm doing a lot of traveling, and it's rather difficult. But Patrick says, when you said at the start that there was no guest, I wasn't sure how it would go, but I got to say I really enjoyed it. Felt like sitting in a hangar with other airplane folks. And we also heard from Kyle, who had kind of a similar comment. He said, I'd like to mention that I don't mind at all when there's an episode without a guest. As much as I enjoy the guests you have on, I more enjoy the commentary between hosts more and discussion of the news. So, yeah, that was interesting feedback, because I'm not sure, or I wasn't sure how well that was being received. So the feedback is helpful. And Patrick also says, regarding the electric airplane race, thanks so much for using metric and not converting everything to American. He says, there's a reason the license plate on one of my vehicles reads metric. And he says, finally, speaking of license plates, your latest survey asks for favorite airplane. Sorry, afraid I couldn't pick just one, so broke it into airliners and fighters. So as David would say, Patrick cheated. For airliner Connie, and for fighter, see the license plate in the attached image. And so we have this very nice Tesla. And David, what's the license plate on the front of this Tesla?
ME262.
Yeah, that's cool.
From, I think, New, is it New, I'm pretty sure it's New Mexico.
No, Utah.
Oh, it's Utah?
Yeah. Maybe that's giving away too much information, but that's pretty cool.
Patrick. Oh, that's true. Oh, okay, we've now identified that Tesla for us. Oh, well.
This is like a total aside, but I've always told people, if I like drop off the face of the planet and nobody can find me, go look in Utah, because that's where I'll be. Utah is just a fascinating place. So I think I'm going to find a way to get myself to Utah next year, and maybe Patrick can show me the observatory. Usually that's a really boring exercise, because that's literally what you're doing is, you know, that is babysitting equipment out in the cold at night when it's dark. So, but apparently that's something that Patrick likes. And then we heard from Brian. He sent us a link to a Skies magazine article. This is Meet Jessica Traynor, Air Canada's youngest female captain. And this is a pretty cool story. Jessica Traynor was 18 in 2009, got her first chance to fly while attending the Aviation Technology Flight Program at Salt College. And then 11 years later, she became the youngest female captain in Air Canada's 83-year history. She'd worked her way all the way to the lead seat aboard the Airbus A320. So that's a very cool story. Congratulations to Jessica. And along with all the other things that we mentioned, we'll have a link to that story in the show notes.
That's one quick progression to captain.
That is very quick. Yeah, yeah. All right. Thanks for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Josie Billington, Director of Flight Operations for Quantum Spatial. Josie, thanks again for coming on the show. Really interesting stuff.
Well, thank you all so very much.
And of course, the website is quantumspatial.com. Nice and easy. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. Also nice and easy for show notes, how to find us on social media, a lot of other good things. And you can find show notes for this episode directly by visiting airplanegeeks.com/626. And you can reach us on email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. So, Max Trescott, where can our listeners find you?
Well, first I want to provide some more travel agent kind of information, because we're here to serve our audience. And if you're in the Boston area, it is an A330, which services Honolulu on Hawaiian Airlines. And it doesn't start until December, and it's going to cost you about $1,000 round trip. So I'm guessing there are going to be a few people that go check that out.
And but the military geek got it right. I just want you to know that.
Good job, David. Yes, and people can always find me at the Aviation News Talk podcast, and we've got a website at aviationnewstalk.com. Click on contact at the top, and you can shoot me an email.
Great. David Vanderhoof, where do listeners find you?
Well, they can find me on Facebook, Twitter, at all the usual places, on Friday mornings on the UAV Digest with that guy, Max Flight. And last but not least, you can join our Slack listener team. And I thought today I'd give you a little tiny bit of what Slack is, if you're not sure. It's a social media conferencing product. It's confined. We have to admit you into it. But it's a really nice, comfortable space for you to geek out, and nobody will know it but us geeks who are also in it. So you can do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanedeeks.com, and Max and I will send you a link, and you can join the conversation. It's very simple. It's very easy to use, and a lot of fun, and a lot of good conversations on things other than just airplanes and drones. You know, there's a Formula One conversation that I never can understand about something about tires and slicks and stuff that I keep going in, as well as events. So we definitely would like you to be part of that community.
For sure. And you can find me on LinkedIn. Just look for Max Flight, like David said, at theuavdigest.com. Also at paxxpodcast.com, talking about the passenger experience. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.